All right, morning, guys. I got a good view of the ceiling, so I can't see you, but that's all right. I can see the other guys that are on the Zoom session. Not sure if you're allowing women in the group yet or not, but so we're going to look at Genesis chapter 38 today, and I'm going to start out, and I'm going to read through Genesis 38. It's not that long of a chapter. And I kind of do like to just read it through without breaking it up with commentary sometimes, just in case you haven't read it recently. So Genesis chapter 38 says, at that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. There, Judah met with the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and made love to her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who he named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kezib that she gave birth to him. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, he may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live with her father's household. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira the Adullamite went with him. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Anaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that, though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come now, let me sleep with you. And what will you give me to sleep with you? She asked. I'll give you a young goat from my flock, he said. Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it? She asked. He said, what pledge should I give you? Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand, she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Anaim? There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here, they said. So he went back to Judah and said, I didn't find her. Besides, the men who lived there said, there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep what she has, or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you didn't find her. About 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant. Judah said, bring her out and have her burned to death. As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. I am pregnant by the man who owns these, she said. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah. And he did not sleep with her again. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. As she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand. So the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on the wrist and said, this one came out first. But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out, and she said, so this is how you have broken out. and she named him Perez. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was named Zerah. So an interesting little chapter here. We won't get into the medical aspects of whether or not it's a good idea to tie something onto a fetus that's only partway out of the womb and then have it go back in and spread whatever disease is on the piece of thread. But I want to start out and just tell you a little personal story. Last week, I was down in Atlanta with my wife. We were visiting my sister and her husband. And I was talking to my sister one day at the breakfast table, and she was she plays a lot of tennis. Atlanta's a big, huge tennis town. And she was telling me about one of the teams that she's the captain of. She has a woman on the team who is repeatedly late to their tennis matches. And when they have these matches, they're given 15 minutes of grace time. And then if you don't show up for the match, you forfeit. And so this woman is like, she said 80 or 90% of the time, she's late getting there. And she comes late, never apologizes to her doubles partner, never apologizes to the other team, just gets her stuff out and starts playing. And when they're playing, this woman, she said, one of the things that she does is complain a lot on the court. And so she was telling me about an incident a little while ago where one of the women on the opposing team was foot faulting. And foot faults are rarely called in tennis. And if there's no official or anything, they usually just, you know, go unnoticed. But this woman would, when the other woman foot faulted, after the point was over, the woman would turn to her partner and say loud enough so the other team could hear it, "Did you see her foot fault? She shouldn't be doing that." And so they finish out the match, and especially if they lost, she said this woman would, they'd sit down next to each other on the benches, and again, she'd start complaining to her partner, "Yeah, if those people wouldn't have been foot faulting all the time, we probably would have won." So my sister said a couple things are interesting about that. You know, one, the fact that she's never apologetic about being late. Oh, and she said this woman also complains if anyone else is like 2 minutes late, even though she's almost 15 minutes late every time. She said that, I lost my train of thought. So they're sitting on the bench. She foot faulted. And okay, so she's on the bench. She complains about the foot fault so the other people can hear it. And then a lot of times they'll go out like for breakfast or lunch afterward or whatever. And my sister says to me, you know, so this woman is so unapologetic. She's complaining all the time. She said, another thing is this woman herself foot faults all the time and nobody calls it on her. And she doesn't even realize that she foot faults, denies it. Somebody mentioned it once. She said, no, I don't foot fault. But she said, every time they go out for breakfast or lunch afterward, this woman prays after the food comes before they start eating. And my sister looks at me, and my sister knows I'm a Christian. My sister isn't. She says, there's a word for that. She said, like hype or hips. It begins with an H, doesn't it? I said, yeah, hypocrite. She said, yeah, that's it. So you may, and I told my sister, I said, that's pathetic that this woman, you know, is just totally unaware of everything going on around her and then sits there and makes a big show about praying before eating her food. So this does have a connection to this morning's lesson. When you read Genesis 38, and you know, I've studied this before, and you read a lot of, you know, commentaries and sermons by people, there's sort of two main things that that people talk about on this. And actually, as you know, probably from attending church and listening to pastors' sermons, you know, anybody can make a whole talk on any one sentence anywhere in the Bible. But the two main things that seem to get talked about over and over again are the fact that Tamar is in Jesus's genealogy, and then Judah, the fact that he demonstrates this, you know, sort of lack of self-awareness about his own behavior in the story. So I'll just quickly mention a couple of things about those. The genealogy of Jesus is it shows up two times in the gospel, once in Matthew and once in Luke. And I had probably heard this before, but didn't really retain the knowledge. So the genealogy of Matthew being a Jew, when he wrote his gospel, he gave the legal genealogy for Jesus according to Jewish custom. And according to Jewish custom, the genealogy always goes through the father. In this case, even if the father isn't actually the biological father of Jesus, which Joseph wasn't. And the genealogy not only always goes through the father, it only goes back to the point of Abraham, and it stops there, because Abraham was the father of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people really don't care about any genealogy before that. It's not important to them. Luke, however, was writing for a Gentile audience. And in Luke chapter 3, when you read his genealogy, he actually takes Jesus's genealogy all the way back to Adam, the father of the human race, not just to Abraham. And it's interesting, when you read the genealogy, it's not, for the most part, it's different people. It's right after Joseph, the father or stepfather of Jesus, it starts out with different people. And there's speculation about why that is, and the speculation seems to make sense, but since there isn't actually a definitive statement about it, it is just speculation, but it makes a lot of sense. And that is that Luke was a doctor. People think that he may have been a Gentile, although there's no consensus on that either. But they believe that he's giving a biological genealogy, which would sort of make sense. And so therefore, they say, this is the genealogy of Mary, Jesus's mother, that shows up in Luke, as opposed to the genealogy of Jesus that shows up in Matthew, which is of Joseph's father. Nonetheless, and this is the thing that people point out, Tamar happens to be in both genealogies, which means she's probably like the seventh cousin 15 times removed, Mary was, of Joseph. Okay, so they both trace back through Tamar. And people often point out that, you know, the Bible is so authentic because it doesn't, try and hide the fact that Tamar, who had this illegitimate son through Judah, was in Jesus's genealogy. And so that's one of the points that's often brought out about this chapter. One other thing that I found as I was looking up this genealogy stuff and stuff on Bibles in general, this has nothing to do with anything, but it's just a quick snippet that I thought you'd be interested in. So since the 1980s, it's estimated that there have been 100 million Bibles printed each year, which I thought was a colossal number. Half of those Bibles since the 1980s, 100 million each year, which I think turns out to be like 4.5 billion Bibles since the 1980s. Half of those have been printed in China. So I just thought that was interesting. The same China that confiscates Bibles and people had to be so cautious about bringing them in is printing the majority of the Bibles in the world. So the second point in this chapter, and it's pretty much just Tamar and Judah in this chapter. So we have this situation where Judah wants to have Tamar burned because she prostituted herself and got pregnant. And yet he doesn't seem to have a problem with the fact that he was sleeping with a prostitute, which he didn't know was Tamar at the time. But so there's this, whatever you want to call it, a little bit of hypocrisy or basically lack of self-awareness on Judah's part that, you know, he's even doing something morally wrong and he's going around pointing out other people's foot faults, if you will, and not paying attention to his own foot fault. He just is clueless, so to speak. So why do we want to become self-aware, I guess would be a question that we could ask. When we see the truth about ourselves, when we admit our own weaknesses and sins and ask for forgiveness for them, it should become easier for us to be empathetic toward others and to forgive them. That would be one thing that self-awareness might cause. When we see that we have our own personality quirks and odd ways of behavior that we either don't want to change or are powerless to change, and we want people to just understand that this is who we are, it should make us a little bit, again, more empathetic and tolerant of other people's personality quirks and odd ways of behavior, and perhaps a little better able to understand just who they are. I had a situation yesterday where I had asked someone to make a call to a person in a business setting and ask them a simple, what I thought was a simple question, and get like a two-word answer. And this person texted back and said, "I'm not comfortable texting this person and asking him this question." And I thought, at first I thought, what? And so I wrote back and I said, "It's just a simple, innocent question. You know, you don't have to tell him that it was your idea. Just tell him I just, you know, needed to know this information. I didn't really have a relationship with this other person, didn't have their phone number, otherwise I would have done it." And this person said, "No, I just can't do that." And then they said a couple other reasons about why, and they said that even if we don't have the information, so and so should be doing this anyway. And I remembered a couple things that we've discussed actually in our groups lately. And one was to take a while and be quiet and not respond. And so this person put these things out there in the text, and I didn't say anything for like 3 hours as I just thought about this. And then again, things that we've talked about in our group here, I was like, okay, why is this person doing this? So we just talked about, you know, personality quirks and I just couldn't understand it. And I said, okay, I just sort of forced myself to try and say, okay, what is this person? Where are they coming from? And it almost didn't make any difference. I just finally concluded that they're not going to do it. I shouldn't try and force them to do it. They're different than I am. I can't really understand fully why they didn't want to, but it was just very clear that they didn't want to. So after 3 hours of not responding to the text, which is very unusual. Any of you who text me know that I usually respond within about 3 seconds. I sent back a text and I just said, "Got it." And that was all. And the person wrote back to me and said, "Thank you so much for understanding." At which point I had huge amounts of guilt come over me because I wasn't really trying to be understanding necessarily. I was just trying to end the text and let them know that I hadn't totally ignored them. And I thought "got it" was an innocuous way to say it. And I even thought about saying, "Okay, I understand where you're coming from," but I didn't say that. I just said "got it." And so even in my attempt to be empathetic and to be aware of what was going on, I really didn't get it enough. And then when they, I almost had this feeling come over me like Judah did here in, where is this, in verse 26, after he sees the seal and the cord, and he says, Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah." And it just hit me that I still have so far to go in being understanding and empathetic with other people. So I'm going to talk just for a little bit about not necessarily what's in this chapter, but about thoughts that I've been having lately about Bible study. So when we read the Bible, we learn what God is like. We learn something about what other people are like, which sort of means we learn something about what we ourselves are like. And we also learn what God asks of us as we read through the Bible. But the thought that came to my mind is God doesn't want me to have a relationship with a book. He wants me to have a relationship with Him. You know, you can't experience New York City or Rome or Paris or London from reading about those places in a book. You have to actually be there in person. So I was asking myself, you know, what does God really want from me? Does He want me to learn about Him and learn more about Him by reading the Bible? Or does He actually want me to do what the Bible says? What would my life look like if I focused as much on following Jesus and doing what God says and asks me to do as I did on reading the Bible and doing Bible study and increasing my knowledge? And you know, all of us have different levels to which we do that. I mean, I enjoyed getting into this chapter this time and reading about all these little nuances and whatnot. And yet, I started to think, you know, I've been a Christian for like 35 years or so. And it's like if reading the Bible is how we get a good idea of who God is and what He wants from our life on this earth, am I really not sure yet of who God is and what He wants from my life? And if I'm not, I'm not sure that reading about Tamar and her genealogy place in Jesus' genealogy, or even reading the story about Judah's lack of self-awareness is really going to get me over the hump. So there's nothing inherently wrong with reading and studying the Bible. In 2 Timothy 3:16, 17, we've all read this many times. It says, all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness, so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. And sometimes people quote that verse and they stop after verse 16 and they forget that, so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. But I think this is God saying, there's a reason that I want you to read the Bible, because I want you to pick up on, here's what I want you to be doing. And I'll give you some tips for it. And it's fine to read the Bible and to know what these tips are from God and to know who God is. But, and again, maybe this is just where my head was at this week. Why am I doing the reading? Because I enjoy doing research, or because I feel better about myself when I'm reading the Bible more? I'll have to raise my hand and admit that if my faith has been lacking a little bit, or I haven't been paying much attention to my relationship with the Lord, if I sit down and read the Bible for a half hour, all of a sudden I've kind of maybe fooled myself into thinking, okay, I'm back on track now. But I'm not really back on track. I've just taken this little diversion into something that seems legitimate and spent a lot of time reading the Bible. And I don't know, when I meet Jesus face to face, or actually maybe even better, when I meet him each day, spirit to spirit, I mean, do you know that? Do I really even focus on that meeting Jesus is not something that happens after we die? He doesn't want that. That wasn't why he came and died. He came and died so we could have this relationship with him right now, every day, and his spirit lives inside of us. And sometimes that we're thinking like, okay, well, it's God the Father over here and the Holy Spirit's inside of us, but Jesus is out here, but they're all one. And so if the Spirit's living inside of us, Jesus is living inside of us. And in fact, it's called the Spirit of Christ, just like our spirit is our spirit. So our spirit, Jesus wants to communicate his spirit to our spirit every single day. And if I'm self-aware enough and having a conversation with the Lord every day about what I did with my day, and if I keep coming back to him and saying, well, I read this, or I learned this, or I studied this, I think he's going to ask me every day, how did you apply it? He doesn't care that I just read about it or learned about it or ticked off another box on here's another chapter that I read this year, or I'm, you know, going through the Bible and I'm going to achieve this objective of reading it. He wants to know how I've applied what I've learned. And that's pretty much, I think, all he really cares about. There's a saying that I heard in a sermon recently, and the saying was, a faith that hasn't been tested can't be trusted. So I did a little Google research on that. I love to do research. And there's no way to determine who first said this. It's quoted like in hundreds of different sermons. It's not a verse from the Bible. There's a verse in James that's a little bit like that. But these actual words, you put them in quotes on the search, you can get those exact words used by certain people. Pastors use this all the time. A faith that hasn't been tested can't be trusted. You can do all the Bible study and reading that you want to try to build up your faith, but if you don't actually get out in the world and put it to the test, you really don't know if your faith can be trusted. There's a story in Matthew chapter 10, verses 17 to 22, and I think it's sometimes called the story of the rich young man or the parable of the rich young man. I'll just read this quick. It's like five or six verses. As Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him. Good teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? In other words, how should I be living my life to please you? Why do you call me good? Jesus answered. No one is good except God alone. You know the commandments. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. You shall not defraud. Honor your father and your mother. Teacher, he declared, all these I have kept since I was a boy. Okay, he's saying, I've built my faith on keeping these commandments. Jesus looked at him and loved him. And I've never really, that's verse 21, I've never really focused on that second part there. Why didn't it just say, Jesus looked at him and said, one thing you lack? It doesn't. It says, Jesus looked at him and loved him, and then put a period there. One thing you lack, go sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad because he had great wealth. And so when people preach sermons about this or you study it in a Bible study, there's always this connection about the wealth and the fact that this guy had this great wealth and he couldn't part with his wealth. I don't know that at this point any longer, I think that that's the main point of this. I think what it has to do with is finding out, Jesus wanting this guy to find out, where was his faith at? And so he's doing to this guy what Jesus does to any of us, and it's testing us. All the time, Jesus is testing us. He wants to take us to places where we're not comfortable, because we're not going to know how strong our faith is if we just stay in the places where we're comfortable. So with this particular guy, he's saying, sell everything you have, get rid of all that stuff. And that might be one thing that's going to tell him how strong his faith is. But then he says, come follow me. And there's a whole implication of what the follow me is that this guy is then going to have to do. And in following Jesus, he's going to find out, did all these commandments that he really, that he learned about and tried so diligently to obey, like all good Jewish people should, did they really give him a faith that was the kind of faith that would allow him to follow Jesus? Well, he wouldn't know until he actually did it. And all the Bible study and reading and research that I do, does it really give me a faith that's going to allow me to follow Jesus and do what he wants me to do? I won't know until I actually get out there and start doing it. So I'll conclude with a phrase from Stuart Briscoe that I heard one of the first times I ever heard him preach. He was talking about something not being an either or, but rather being a both and. Okay? And so life isn't either read the Bible or apply what's in it. It's both read the Bible and apply what's in it. And I don't have any problem reading the Bible. I still do it. I'll still continue to do it. But I really hope that God's Spirit can somehow get it through my head that that's not the main reason that God put me on this earth. It's not the main reason that he wrote the Bible, is so that I could exercise my intellectual muscles and learn some things and be able to regurgitate them and make people think that I know what's what with the Bible. So that's about a half hour. It's good to be with all you guys this morning, and enjoy the questions. I wrote four of them just in case you don't find the first three exciting to talk about. You can talk about the fourth one. So good seeing you all. Thanks a lot.